How do we know when something is crossing over from the good thing that it's designed for to, I'm using this to medicate?
When there is a compulsion to do it, when it might be causing harm and you continue to do it in spite of that harm, when it's causing conflict between you and other people, or even like conflict within yourself. So you say, I'm not going to do that again, and then you go and do it. Like that would be when there's preoccupation there. So it's the only thing you can think of, or it's taking up a lot of thinking time or planning time. When you've tried to stop, but you can't. When you need more of it in order to feel okay. Yeah, they'd be some of the... Just off the top of my head.
Hello, welcome back to the WOW Level Life podcast. We are now a few episodes into this new format, and the feedback has actually been pretty incredible. And today we get to jump into an interview episode where we unpack some of the themes that you heard in last week's story about Maya Angelou. This week we're sitting down, as you heard last week, with a friend, a therapist, a poet, speaker, facilitator. Her name is Jackie Power. She is a specialized therapist in addiction psychology and counseling. She also has a lot of expertise in social media addiction. But one of my favorite things about her is that she is also an extraordinary poet and a published award-winning one. Her poetry has been published in various anthologies. She is the author of the book, Stop the World, I Want to Get Off. She's the creator and host of the Therapeutic Poet podcast. She's also performed her one-person show at the Edinburgh Fringe Festival. Very, very prestigious. And so again, from master practitioner to experiential work, so much training, so much expertise. And I'm just thrilled that we got to have this conversation. She's just a lovely human being. She's based in the United Kingdom, in the country of England. And she's just a thrill to have a conversation with. You guys are going to love this one. So let's just jump straight into it, because this conversation is going to stir your imagination, get you curious. It's going to warm your heart, and it's going to awaken some of your wonder. Listen in to my conversation with Jackie Power. Jackie, I almost said thanks for staying up late, but it's not that late.
No. Okay. No. It's a murky afternoon.
That's where I'm at. It's fine. Murky, because I see a window behind you and it looks like the sun is shining and it's a nice day outside.
No, you've actually cheered me up by having this conversation. It was so miserable this morning. The rain is pouring down. It's a very stereotypical British day today.
Perfect. So let's talk about trauma.
Yeah, let's just jump on in there. Jump in that puddle.
Yeah. I mean, if that's the way it is outside, sometimes that's the way it feels inside.
Yes.
I've heard some pretty bad definitions about trauma lately. I think in general, there's just a lot of bad psychology going around. Have you noticed that everyone's a therapist?
Everyone's trauma-informed now. Everyone's
trauma-informed. That's what it is.
Yeah. Yeah, because that's the buzzword now, right? That's, you know, it was mental health a couple of years ago, and now it's moved into trauma. So.
Yeah. Let's talk about that for a second. I know it's a seemingly, we're talking about the weather, and so it's like, well, why not? Let's talk about pros and cons. I would assume, from your perspective, there are some benefits and advantages to the fact that people are having more conversations about trauma and more aware of mental health. And maybe even some awareness around some of the terms that licensed, trained mental health professionals like you have known about, but those are sort of finding their way into the public square. Before we get to the cons, let's start with just kind of the pros. What are you noticing about how, I don't know how much the culture here in the US is different from throughout Europe, but what are the benefits of the average person living with a more day-to-day awareness of the role of trauma in their lives?
Well, I think it's just understanding the impact that life has on the way that we function. So whereas before we might have judged someone for them having what could be called like an ab reaction to something, right? Where they flip out a bit. And that person could have been judged because of that. I think now we're starting to understand, maybe they don't have much capacity before they flip into a fight flight response or, you know, or a freeze response. I think that's something that's has been really misunderstood, is the freeze response. That's why you get a lot of victim blaming type of stuff. And I think that's that's changing, because people are understanding that this is it's a typical physiological way that we respond to something that's unpredictable, that feels isolating to us, that's dramatic, that we don't have the resources to respond to. I mean, that's what trauma, you know, is, you know, when we don't have the resources and we can't manage our way through that situation.
Yeah. How would you define trauma? What's your kind of working definition?
Well, there's the UDIN definition, which is that I can't remember the U now, but it's dramatic, it's isolating, you don't have the resources to, and unexpected, dramatic, isolating, and no resources to deal with it. But I like what people are beginning to say now. I think Dr. Gabor Mate talks about, it's not what's happened to you, but it's about what happens sort of within. Mm-hmm. And that's really what we're talking about when we're talking about trauma, because you could experience something, Harris, and you don't have a trauma response to it, but I do, because of my capacity to be able to manage through that. For me, when we're talking about trauma, is the idea is that we all have this sort of window of tolerance where we can regulate ourselves again back into a state of homeostasis, of calm, of, you know, connecting with other people. If something happens and I'm not able to do that, then that's really, we're talking then we have a trauma response. So the first thing we might do is we might go into a fight response or a flight response, or we might go into a freeze, flop, fawn. They're the five like Fs, if you like. And then we all go through those, but we're able to come back into that kind of regulated state. Trauma is when we get stuck into that state and it's not easy for us to be able to come back and regulate ourselves.
Yeah.
That's a very long definition.
No, it's not. It's great. I appreciate your attention to detail. You know, I, for a while, when I first became kind of obsessed, is probably a fair word, with this topic, and kind of went down the rabbit hole and started researching, I bumped into someone who I was having kind of public conversations with. And one time he used the definition, anything less than affirming and nurturing. Yeah. And I was like, oh, wow, that's almost everything. And now in hindsight, I look back and go, I don't know if I feel comfortable with the definition of trauma of anything less than affirming. I don't know, affirming is a big word these days and has a lot of politics associated with it. But like, if that's true, then as I go throughout my day, you know, if I say something to my wife in the kitchen and she doesn't immediately affirm how I feel in that moment, does that mean I'm having an experience of trauma?
Well, no, because it comes back to what resources you have, you know. And this is when we start talking about ACEs, you know, adverse childhood experiences, attachment, the way that our caregiver has been emotionally attuned to us, our genetics, our, you know, our social standing, our, like these all contribute. So it's not necessarily the event. And I think this is where things have shifted, because we used to say that what people call like big T traumas, you know, so earthquakes, fires, floods, those kind of things. And what we're understanding now is that, like I said, you know, based on how well resourced I am or I'm not, my capacity to be able to regulate myself, then that can be traumatic.
Yes. You know? Perhaps it's not healthy for us walking around thinking that everything that makes us feel uncomfortable is trauma.
Definitely not. In fact, we need discomfort. We need those ruptures, because, you know, there's a term in gardening, and there's a really long word, but when little shoots are sprouting up, you're meant to kind of like waft your hand over. If you're in a greenhouse, you're meant to waft your hand over them, right? Because that makes these little shoots believe that they're in a windy atmosphere, and they could kind of be uprooted at any moment. So what do? It enforces them to grow their roots stronger, right? Yeah. Similar kind of principle. We need those ruptures because it helps us to grow our roots stronger. Now, for some, we have those roots developed because we came from a healthy background of, you know, a pretty functional family. Mm-hmm. So growing those roots is easier than for others, where it's easily for them to get uprooted when adverse things happen to them.
Yes.
Does that make sense?
It makes total sense. If for some reason that old quote is coming to mind, I'm going to butcher it. I don't remember it exactly, but it's the idea that hard times create hard men. Hard men create good times create soft men. Soft men create hard times. Basically, there's this cycle where when things get simple or easier, there's less of that stress, less of that wind blowing, less of that hand wafting, and we're not as resilient. And with that lack of resiliency comes a fragility or a weakness, I suppose. And I think, is that what we're seeing right now? We're seeing this rise in mental health at the forefront of the conversation. Everyone's now talking about mental and emotional health. But in some ways, like if I talk to my grandparents about this, they're like, man, what a luxury. You know, I don't know if that's a fair assessment, but from their perspective, they're like, what a luxury to be able to value your emotional health from day to day and choose work that brings you joy, that is deeply meaningful and purposeful to you. When I was a kid, they would say like it was about waking up before the sun came up to get ready to go do your work for the day. Optimal emotional wellness wasn't the top priority, right? What's your assessment of that? Are we experiencing a little bit of soft times and soft men and women, so to speak?
I don't think it's fair to blame it on sort of the, you know, soft men and women. I think it's a setup, and I think it comes from something that I rail against, which is the medicalization of our emotions, right? Ooh. That we have this medical model that deals with mental health. So if I'm feeling grief for longer than 6 months when somebody has died, then, hey, careful, I might be, you know, falling into a grief disorder, right? We have stopped talking about our feelings. Well, maybe we never did. I think we've sort of bypassed it from not talking about our feelings to now talking about our mental health. Mm. But if we actually talked about our feelings, you know, then we would understand that they're the most renewable resource that we have. And they are something to be used to process our human experience that helps to build connection together. Now, I think what's happening in the field of mental health is that if I have a mental health label, that gives me access to resources that I might not otherwise have. It validates my experience. It makes, you know, me feel seen in a distressing, you know, situation. But it's not actually getting to the root of solving that situation, which is increasing somebody's capacity for discomfort and giving them the resources that they need. You know, resources and resilience, that's what good, inverted commas, mental health, I think, is.
Yeah, that's so good. Well, I know this was an interesting place to start a conversation like this on a podcast called The Wow Level Life. But I think so much of what we're talking about when we're in pursuit of a life that we would be considered to be wow level is to have an honest conversation about our mental and emotional well-being. And there just seems to be a lot of stuff floating around the internet these days. And now everyone is sort of an armchair psychologist, it seems. And, you know, we have practically kids walking around that are, in your words, trauma-informed, so to speak, diagnosing their friends. I've had examples of previous team members that we've let go of go on public podcasts and have conversations about me as, and like label me as a, I forgot what it's called, some kind of narcissistic disorder. It's like, wow, this is a lot of dangerous stuff when we as a culture feel so equipped to diagnose others and talk about them as if we're all trained professionals.
Yeah. And it's dangerous because, you know, I mean, my son came to me recently and he said, my youngest, he said, I really like it when things are neat on my shelf. Do you think I've got OCD? I said, no, I think you like being neat. Listen, and it's not about, and we have to be careful, right? Because it's not about disparaging any of these conditions. You know, this isn't saying that these conditions aren't real. It's not saying that people aren't suffering, but it's saying that we seem to put the suffering out there as if we're not meant to suffer, as if we're not meant to feel discomfort and pain. Mm-hmm. There's a great book, Philip Yancey's Where Is God When It Hurts? And he talks about how necessary pain is. You know, when we go and touch a boiling pot, we know that it's damaging to us because we feel the pain of the heat on our fingers. Yeah. And yet we again, live in a society that's trying to medicate the pain away, the discomfort away. And I think we're, you know, you can't make lotus flowers if you don't have mud. You know, like it's, you need that muddiness as well.
So good. Well, one of the ways that you help people do that, that healing work and sit with their feelings, maybe process some of their feelings, is through poetry. In some circles, you're known as the therapeutic poet. Or the poetic therapist. I'm not sure. Sometimes I can think of both ways. What is it about poetry, and what was your introduction to poetry? Was it as a child?
Yeah. My mum always read poetry, and I didn't like it as a kid. I liked child poetry. I didn't like studying poetry. I found studying poetry really scary. and I'm now just my middle son's just doing his, you know, his exams this year, and we're having to study English together, and it's like, oh God, love you, I'll be back here trying to figure out that meter and stanza, and you know. But for me, I always wrote lyrically, you know, it was a way to be able to, it was just my form of writing. And then I think I had a diary that I would write in code when I was a kid, and poetry is like a grown-up code, right? I can tell you something deeply personal about my experience using the metaphor of the sea or of a flower, or, you know, so you will then take that poem and make that experience yours in relation to whatever you have going on in your life. So I think it's a meeting ground, you know, it's a way of me being able to meet other people, but also to meet myself. Like what I can put in a poem helps me to feel witnessed. And I think that was why I did it, because I didn't feel I had any other place where I really felt seen. So I figured out my own way.
Yeah. Well, it's worked well for you. You've had some amazing experiences. You've written multiple books, published books about your poetry out into the world. You've done one-woman shows, right?
Yes.
At festival. Yeah. At Edinburgh, right?
Edinburgh Fringe, yeah.
Yeah.
Hilarious. Cool. Yeah.
And now you're doing lots of meaningful work in the world. You have your own private practice.
Yes.
How are you incorporating poetry into the work that you're doing with clients? Is it teaching them to leverage poetry? Is it simply them doing work through the poetry that you offer them? What role is poetry playing in your work today?
Different levels. So there's one which is out on the sort of the not one-to-one level, so say on social media and things, and it's a way to connect. It's definitely been through the shows. I mean, there was a lot of talk in my shows around mental health. So it has been a way of being able to open up those conversations. I mean, the show I did, Stop the World, I Want to Get Off, my top 10 reasons why I want to leave the planet. You know, I talked a lot in there about mental health, about the way that certain people get to feel like they matter in the world more than others. And that was all done through poetry. So I think I use it a lot to open up sort of broader conversations. And I also have run writing workshops. So I've done them specifically on different emotions. So like one of my favorite ones is on grief, where I use this model of the landscape of grief. So, you know, many people are familiar with the 5 or the 6 stage model of grief, you know, of like anger, bargaining, or depression, all of those sort of phases that people go through. But I don't think grief is that linear. And in the workshop that I do, we look at it as a landscape, and you're in a changed landscape with grief. So then I use different poems that other people have written, that I've written, and invite people to, again, witness. It's about witnessing. The first person, actually, in adulthood, I think, that really needs to witness ourselves is ourselves. Now, therapy can help to create a space for that. But the one that really needs to say, this is my story and I see it, is for ourselves. So, yeah, so mainly through workshops. I mean, I've tried to bring up some of my poems in one-to-one sessions. Funnily enough, people aren't interested because they want to talk about themselves. So, you know, sometimes it can be a bit like, I think this poem could, you know, it could really help you. But they need to be heard. They don't, you know, they don't need my reflection of my poems. So
you're making me think of that great Mary Oliver quote, where she says instructions for living a good life, basically.
Yeah.
Pay attention, be astonished, and then tell about it.
Yeah.
It sounds a lot like one of your views on poetry, is that poetry gives you this way of just sort of paying attention
That's 100% it. Anyone who pays attention is a poet. You don't have to write a poem to be a poet.
Say more about that.
The work has already been done, I think, by the time it's got onto the page. You know, the noticing, the wondering, the reframing, that's the poetic element. You know, by the time it's got onto the page, all of the true essence of poetry has happened, you know.
What is that true essence?
It's almost like it acts as a prism. Or, you know, that when someone is being a poet, you know, there's the noticing and then there's the refracting of that experience so that we see things in a multi-layered way.
So to the person who's out there listening going, I don't have any training on poetry. I don't know how to write poetry. But gosh, there's something about this conversation that's resonating. Maybe I've got, I don't know if it's trauma based on the previous definitions. I've just got some stuff. I have some feelings. We all have feelings. Where would you encourage someone to begin?
Well, you can do two different things, I think. I think, first of all, just writing free flow, just allowing yourself to write. That's what I always start off my workshops with. Just write a stream of consciousness and see what comes out. And then that actually can even be the start of something, because you might notice words that repeat themselves. And so then if you take that thread of the words that repeat themselves and, you know, think about that, and you might want to think about it from a senses point of view, like how does it, you know, if that word keeps on recurring, what does it feel like to me? What texture would it have? What if it was a bird, what bird would it be? You know, you can just start to sort of play. So you can do it free form like that, or you can take, there are so many different poetic forms, right? So there's an acrostic poem, which is where you just take a word and then that letter is the beginning of each line. Or there's a golden shovel poem, which I love, which I do in my Hope workshop, which is where you take an inspirational phrase like "this too shall pass." And then you use the end. So this would be at the end of your first line. "Too" would be at the end of your second line. "Shall" would be the end of your third line, and "pass" would be at the end of your fourth line. So then, okay, what can I write now if I know that they're going to be at the end of those lines? And just play. I think that's the travesty that can happen when people are being educated about poetry, that it's this. I mean, I've got a poem called "Poetry Makes Me Puke," which I wrote for my teenage self. And there's a line in it, it goes, "Isn't it all written by men who are dead or in bed?" Like, you know, because it's like, that's what we learn about poetry, right? The canon, it was full of men, or it's all love poetry that I can't relate to. It's all sonnets, you know? And actually, oh God, there's a poet for everyone out there.
And does it have to rhyme? I think that's the quintessential question.
Yeah, no, I think it's quite unfashionable for it to. I think I'm very unfashionable because I'm very rhymey. But no, I don't know. No, I mean, like, you know, it's just, it's in the noticing. I ended up writing a poem about an aloe vera once, the aloe vera plant. I mean, that's another way you can play, is like close your eyes, open them, what do you see? And then write a poem about that. Just what do you, you know, what do you observe? Yeah. So, but play, it's a lightness, you know, it's an opportunity to play.
Yeah.
And, I just want to add, sorry, Harris, that reminds me, going back to now to trauma and trauma recovery, one of the key things that gets killed in trauma is creativity, because, you know, just the senses are narrowed down and you're in a survival mode. So actually giving yourself that place to play is so reparative as far as trauma is concerned.
Ah, that's so good. And I mean, there's a lot of research now out about different experiential modalities. Why is that? Let's get into the why a little bit. We don't have to get too sciencey, but what is it about this play and creativity? Would you put poetry in the art therapy category?
Yeah, yeah.
Why is that working in ways that just sitting on a couch and counseling isn't?
Because you're occupying a different part of the brain. So the brain that's the talk therapy is all the prefrontal cortex. That's the logic making, that's the sense making. But the part that gets activated when we're distressed or traumatized is the amygdala, is the emotional part. So we have to connect with that part of us in the language that it understands. And the language that it understands is through the body, through the senses, you know, through co-regulation, yeah, through smell, like through touch, all of those kind of things. So, yeah. And the imagination as well, you know, the part, you know, that employs imagination, again, isn't this kind of logical part. It's the creative part of the brain. So it's bringing all of those elements online, which is so healing.
Yeah. Is it possible that there are folks listening to this conversation who have been sitting on a couch talking to a therapist or a counselor for years, wondering why it's, I mean, what would they say? It's not sticking. It's not working. Like, what?
Well, listen, I think witnessing, being witnessed is very important. Mm-hmm. But then you can't get stuck there. And I think what can happen is that people get stuck in their story and can reinforce and re-entrench themselves in their position. And actually, we need to kind of make sense of it, feel seen in that. But telling our story doesn't help us to feel safe. What helps us to feel safe is that co-regulation piece. So you can have that healing in relationship with somebody else, you know, that the way that they regulate themselves as you're talking to them, you know, you unconsciously feed off of that and connect with that. But, you know, sometimes our nervous systems have been so disrupted that there's very little places in which we feel safe. So it's about re-educating our nervous system. And that, you know, that is done through experiential therapies.
What is the difference between that co-regulation you're talking about and coping?
Well, coping is an adaptation. So if you're coping, you're actually kind of gone into a bit of a freeze response because you're kind of, you know, you're tightening up, you're burying all the feelings, and you're not actually in a process of metabolizing that energy, if you like. Whereas, you know, if you're sort of processing that, then that happens through co-regulation, and it takes up the whole body. So it uses the vagus nerve is what helps us co-regulate. So that pays attention through what we see, through what we feel. You know, sometimes when you come up against somebody and you meet someone for the first time and you instantly connect, or you instantly have kind of a bit of aversion to them, that's all your vagus nerve telling you whether you have a sense of safety or not with that person. So it's much cleverer than, you know, than our thinking brains, if you like.
Yeah. You know, to go back to the idea of psychology finding its way across social media platforms with all the advice, coping mechanisms is a phrase that I think I see get thrown around a lot. Is the goal to cope, or is the goal to heal, or is the goal to do both?
Well, I think it's to do both. I mean, definitely there are times where we need to cope, and you kind of, now that makes me sort of think of, you know, of the idea of like the inner child and the inner teenager and the adult, okay? But you can't have your inner child running the show all of the time. So the idea of the inner child is we all have this younger inner child, you know, this beautiful essence of us that can often get wounded in childhood, right? If, you know, if we want that, you know, we can't let that run the show, even if it might be feeling a whole bunch of emotions. So at some times we have to kind of reparent it and go, look, yeah, like I hear you, but now is not the time to have that tantrum, right? That might be a coping thing. A processing thing is then, all right, what do we now go and do with that inner child that's still having that like tantrum or kind of, you know, real resistance to whatever's going on? Because that needs to be heard. It needs to be processed so that it, yeah, can chill out.
Yeah, for sure. You know, talking about the inner child, it takes me back to, I talk a lot about the difference between wow people and how people. And I think a little bit of nurture and a little bit of nature. We tend to have a bent towards starting with wow versus starting with how. And how people, when they're unhealthy, tend to just how every big idea they hear to death. Yeah. The moment possibility or what if comes into their life, or someone's brainstorming and be like, what if we do this? They're like, how's that going to work? And so to stay safe, they use how to sort of medicate their fear, right? And for years, I picked on how people unfairly because as a WOW person and as an evangelist for the role that wonder can play in our lives, I'm just like, guys, we need more awe and wonder. Like, guys, stop howling your WOW to death, right? And then not long into those conversations, I realized, wow, people can also medicate. They can use wonder to medicate against wisdom or being realistic or wise, practicing wisdom in some sort of situation where it's like, you know, you might end up bankrupt and dead in a ditch if you don't listen to the owl person in your life, right? It's interesting to think about that being me letting the inner child run the show. Because I think when you said that, you meant the tantrum side of the inner child that will wreak havoc in front of the tantrum, right?
Yeah.
But there's also the wonder-driven inner child who's wide awake to possibility and believes everything is real with no evidence, which on one hand can be incredibly needed. Like, we need that, and the way that that changes the story that we tell ourselves about what's possible. But I can also let that inner child run the show. And then I'm blind to all wisdom that says, hey, maybe you should pay attention to this. Maybe not everything's going to be okay in every single moment. Maybe you should actually prepare a little bit. Is this making sense at all? And process?
It's making total sense. And I kind of want to keep with the inner child analogy, but it's actually making me think of something else, which I might just throw in things. So Dr. Dan Siegel, who I totally rate, I love all of his stuff. He talks about chaos and control. And what we're trying to do is be sort of with the river of emotions, as he calls it, you know, is have that integration. Mm-hmm. So we might go to the bank of chaos or we might go to the bank of control, but actually it's about integrating both of those. And so going back to the inner child analogy, yes, there is an inner child of wonder and there is an inner child that is resistant. And it's integrating both of those and having fluidity and containment around both of those. Both are welcome, and there's times when you listen to one and meet the needs of one, and there's times when you listen and meet the needs of the other. And that's the agility that kind of the healing work gives you, is that flexibility and agility to be able to kind of, you know, flow with what you need.
I love that. Okay, well, so let's talk about, I said a word there, I said medicate. Let's talk about medication for a second.
Yeah.
We're talking about the pharmaceutical drugs. Obviously, the way that we medicate on a regular basis, a lot of your work these days is focused on not just addiction recovery, but working with family members who are in relationship with someone who is struggling with addiction.
Yeah.
Let's just talk about medication for a second in general. What are some of the basic ways that we as average people living our lives medicate in ways we don't even realize it?
Oh my God, where do I begin? Well, just sort of dissociation through social media, that would be medicating.
Oh, you're just going to go there right out of the gate. And
That's why I did my, that's why I did my
medicate. What are you talking about?
Perfectionism can be a medicator. Being the class clown, you know, laughing things off, they would be all sort of adaptation medicators. I mean, obviously, then you've got your standard ones that people think of, like drugs and alcohol, but work, sex, exercise, anything that can make you feel different, basically, and take you out of yourself.
So some of those things are very good things, particularly sex and exercise.
And so
how do we know when something is crossing over from the good thing that it's designed for to, I'm using this to medicate?
When there is a compulsion to do it, when it might be causing harm and you continue to do it in spite of that harm, when it's causing conflict between you and other people, or even like conflict within yourself. So you say, I'm not going to do that again. And then you go and do it. Like that would be... Mm-hmm. When there's preoccupation there, so it's the only thing you can think of, or it's taking up a lot of thinking time or planning time, when you've tried to stop but you can't, when you need more of it in order to feel okay. Yeah, they'd be some of the just off the top of my head.
So what is the relationship between medicating and addiction? Do we sometimes medicate, but we're not, even if we're medicating from time to time, we're not necessarily addicted? Or is medication usually like I used to have a friend that said, "When where there's smoke, there's fire." Is medication the smoke to the addiction fire?
Well, I mean, you don't get addicted without medicating. So, I mean, but there are so many contributing factors to it becoming an addiction. And I think that can be the, you know, you can get a bit purist about it because you can give up everything, you know, everything that makes you feel different in order to be, you know, recovered, if you like. But humaning is really hard. And I think it would be unrealistic to say that we don't all have some kind of medicators, you know, things that make us feel better. But it's about, is that a healthy relationship? And are we ignoring the consequences of what it's doing to us or our relationship with that? And that's causing us harm. So there is no such thing as a good addiction. That doesn't exist. Because you can't, you know, people joke, I'm addicted to exercise. I'm addicted, you know, and it's a good addiction. The whole definition of addiction is it causes harm and you continue to do it even though it causes harm. Hmm.
Would medication fall into the same category? Do we sometimes medicate in healthy ways? Is that similar to self-soothing or those coping mechanisms we talked about?
I would call it self-soothing. I mean, I said, God, it's a bit splitting hairs, isn't it? I don't know. I mean, if you think, you know, if you take an aspirin or, you know, take a headache tablet because you've a headache, then that's medicating it. If you're continuing to do that and you're getting migraines and you are using more and more and you don't actually think about looking at the root reason, you know, you're not hydrating well, you're overworked, you know, all of these other things, then that's where it would start to be problematic. So I think when there's a continual need to medicate in that way and you're not looking at the root reasons as to why, that's when alarm bells might start ringing.
So if the alarm bell started ringing for someone when you said the words social media as a form of medicating,
yeah,
actually social media that they're addicted to? Probably not, right? Is that social media as a form of medicating for something else?
It's the high that they're getting from the validation or the sense of connection or the sense of feeling seen. But also, you know, the social media companies are very astute in giving us those little dopamine hits. So that little pink dot on a certain social media platform, like, is specifically pink because red is, you know, we're wired to pay more attention to red because, you know, that's an idea of danger. So there's like little biohacks that they're doing. Also the scrolling thing, like, you know, it's a bit like the when you're in the slot machines, you know, and you're kind of, I'm doing the hand now, but you know, yeah, when you're doing those one-arm bandit, that's the word. It's like that one-arm bandit kind of thing. Again, that produces a hit to our dopamine circuit. Also intermittent rewards. So the fact that there's sometimes likes and then there's other times that there's not likes, it means that our emotional connection with those likes is higher. So we seek more of that. So don't be too hard on yourself. Like, it is totally wired to hook us in.
I feel like we could do an entire episode just on this.
Well, it's fascinating. So I did research on attachment style and Facebook addiction. And so depending on your attachment style, so if you've got like an anxious ambivalent attachment style, which means then you've got like what are called like protest behaviors. So, oh, you do like me, it's okay, everything's, you know, and you've got that reassurance behavior, then you're much more likely to have an addictive relationship with Facebook, which is about you posting pictures and, you know, and you getting that validation of likes. People that have like a secure kind of attachment where they're emotionally available to others and see the world as being a safe place to be emotionally available, they're more likely to use Messenger within Facebook and just to use it as a form of communication. So I know.
Fascinating. There's an old study that's coming to mind. I don't remember it enough to speak intelligently about it, but it was essentially comparing the similarities between like a cocaine addiction and social media usage. And I think, if I remember correctly, it had something to do with dopamine.
Yes. Yeah. The parts of the brain that it lights up are the same. And then if you start getting into porn addiction, that's where it's particularly difficult, and with algorithms and the way that they're developing all of the algorithms. And it, you know, I mean, I have a line where it's like when too much is not enough, and they keep on the way that they're twisting the algorithms to keep you hooked in. I mean, that you know, you can't fight against that kind of stuff. I mean, it's totally biohacking you.
Yes. Wow. So how do we stand a chance? I think we need people like you in the world helping us get healthy. You're doing that in a variety of ways through your entire body of work, through your shows, your books, your writings, your poetry, being willing to be generous with your time and sit down for a conversation like this. For those of us who are trying to live a life more awake to wonder and more full or more creative expression in our story, one of the things that you're working on lately is a program in which you are coming alongside people who are in relationship with someone who is struggling with addiction.
Yeah.
Talk a little bit about that before we wrap up this conversation.
Well, I kept on going to different conferences and hearing from people who had their own story of addiction recovery. And that's not my story. And so, and I have a story around addiction recovery, which is loving those with addiction. And I just realized it was like, and I'm very used to kind of hiding in plain sight. I mean, that's why I write poetry, right? That's kind of, and I think that that's something that people who love someone with an addiction do, because so much of the emphasis of the attention and energy is put on the person with the addiction, because that's where the crisis point is, right? And so I just suddenly had this, I was like, where, who's taking care of the people that, you know, that are behind the scenes dealing with all of this? Because addiction affects the whole family. And, you know, if you can get the partners or the parents or, you know, whoever it is to also be doing their own work as they walk alongside that person with the addiction, then there is a better chance of that person having longevity in their recovery. Now, that's not saying that those other people cause or can cure or, you know, someone's addiction, not at all, but just being in a supportive environment where it comes back down to people feeling safe, seen and soothed. You know, when people are reaching out in addiction, they don't feel safe, seen and soothed. I mean, I say they feel isolated, dysregulated, and they're medicated. You know, that's how they're trying to cope with it. So I wanted to provide something where people could feel educated about addiction, because there's not a lot of education out there for the families. I wanted them to understand that rather than hearing there's nothing you can do until they hit their rock bottom, that actually there's a lot that you can do to take care of yourself. You know, you can learn about how to set boundaries. You can learn about how to trust yourself. You can learn about healthy communication. You can learn about what a good healthy relationship looks like. You can learn about how to talk to your children about addiction, about how to talk to your children's teacher about addiction, you know, because we need to make this a common conversation, because addiction is rife. You know, there's so much of it that's out there. And we talk a lot about destigmatizing addiction. And a lot of stories come from those who are in addiction recovery to destigmatize it. But we need to be having wider conversations, because I think there are so many people out there that feel that they can't share their story because their story is about somebody else. You know, the impact that they have received is as a result of somebody else's behavior. But actually, if we have more of those open conversations, will realize that this, you know, the common enemy, if you like, is the addiction, but actually it's not an enemy. It served a purpose. So if we twist it around and go, what purpose is this serving? And how can we stop that being the go-to? Then I think, you know, so much change is possible.
Well, your passion and your expertise are both so evident on this subject. And there's probably some folks listening in going, oh, I wish I lived in the UK. So I could be a part of something like that. And the reality is this is available to anyone in the world because of the way you're making it available online virtually.
Yeah. That's right, yeah.
So talk a little bit about what does that look like week in and week out?
So it's a 12-week program that I'm starting, and we start off with people telling their story. But the way that, you know, that we're going to do that, it's not, I'm really aware that people might feel very self-conscious about doing that. So, you know, listen, I'm a poet and a storyteller, so I come up with different ways of people being able to tell their story without feeling exposed. The reason that we need to do that, first of all, is because you cannot set boundaries or think about self-trust or think about healthy communication if you don't have a strong sense of self. So it's a 12-week program. It's online through an app. I've got loads of help up there so people can take their time over reading about addiction and family roles and healthy communication and all that sort of stuff. And then each week we have an online community call for 90 minutes where I'll be doing tapping as well. I'm trained in EFT tapping to help regulate people. So that'll be, bring everyone down and feel calm. There's videos that they can use at any time they want to. I've got music playlists for, when you're feeling angry or despair or you need to soothe your inner child, because these are the things that, these are the little bits that I think are so important when you're dealing with something like this, that when you're feeling so alone, just to know that there's a go-to playlist that you can go and stomp your feet to or have a writing exercise to help move you through despair or, and then scripts as well. So I've been developing scripts, having worked with clients who've said, we really want to talk to our kids' teacher about what's going on. How do we do that? And we'll be building those up over time. So it's really collaborative. I mean, I'm they're of service, really. If people say, I want to know more about this, then I'll happily provide it. So I think that's what I'm excited about. It's like I've got this framework, but it's a collaborative community.
Yeah, and so practical. I love the practicality of everything you just said. So, yeah. All right. So for anyone who's listening in, who's curious and wants to learn more, what's the best way for them to learn?
Yeah. So if they visit my website, www.jackiepower.com, that's Jackie with a Y, and then /feelingfreedom. They'll find more information there.
So Jackie Power, JACKYPOWER, jackiepower.com/feelingfreedom. Much more important than just finding it is the ability to feel it.
Absolutely. Gosh,
this has been so good. I could talk for hours and hours and hours and hours with you about so many things. I just love your unique perspective and outlook on the world, but not just the way that you see the world, but the way that you help us find our place in it through all these different creative forms. What a joy. I'm just grateful that you'd be willing to sit down and have this conversation. Thank you.
Oh, thank you for having me on. It's been a pleasure. Thank you, Harris.
You're so welcome. As we wrap this up, I want to kind of pass the mic back to you. Final words to anyone out there who, actually, can I put you on the spot? Can we do a poem?
What kind of poem?
To anyone who's out there is like, gosh, I needed this episode. I was struggling today. The wonder felt like it was slipping through my fingers. I'm experiencing a lot of the things that you're talking about, Jackie. I'm scrolling social media. I'm looking for the dopamine hit. I'm just struggling to get through my day. Maybe it's a family member who is struggling with addiction. Whatever it is that resonated with them, like just a word of encouragement and hope that might inspire them to keep going.
Okay, I'm going to read my When I Say I'm Feeling Low, Low.
Okay. When I say I'm feeling low, low.
When I say I'm feeling low, low, I need an, oh no, how so? Let the tears flow, have a good old blow. That will let me know that you know that my low, low will surely go, 'cause I'm a pro at handling my low, low. I know it's just another string from my long ago bow. I don't need a should show of out you go, or a tell and show of how you overthrow your low, low, or a just go with the flow. Let me be so full of my woeful, and in time, my low-low will go.
See, I told you so. I told you Jackie was an amazing human being. Wasn't that conversation incredible? And she's also fun to listen to. I know this podcast already has an audience around the world, but here in America, we just, gosh, that warm, lovely, soothing British accent. What a joy to listen to, but more importantly, the depth at which she communicates. So much wisdom to offer us. And I'm so glad that you joined us for this episode to listen into my conversation with Jackie. If you want to learn more about her, head over to jackiepower.com. Jackie, JACKYPOWER, jackiepower.com. And make sure you go pick up a copy of her book, Stop the World, I Want to Get Off. It's an incredible anthology of amazing poetry. And I'm not the kind of guy that reads stacks of poetry books, but I love Jackie's poetry. For some reason, every now and then you just flip through a page, read the right poem, or I have the benefit of, reaching out to her and being like, hey, do you have a poem on this? And she always has one. And it's Gosh, I love listening to it. So pick up a copy. And if you enjoyed this episode, that's a great way to say thank you for her. You know, podcasts like this are oftentimes a labor of love. You don't hear any ads playing on this podcast, most likely, at least not at this stage, right? Maybe years from now. I don't know what's going to happen. But if you're listening to this episode, the chances are pretty good you haven't heard any ads. No one's pitched you anything. No one's tried to get you to buy anything. And so a great way of just saying thanks, if you got value out of this, go order that person's book. It's like a way of dropping a little tip into a tip jar and saying, wow, Jackie, thank you. I got some value out of that conversation. So go check her out. Again, you can learn it all at JackiePower.com. All right, next week, I'm going to be sitting down with my go-to co-host, Kate, for an Afterglow episode where we're going to take some of the themes that came out of this conversation, whether it's defining trauma and the role of poetry and creativity in both processing emotions and healing from some of that trauma, whether it's medicating emotions and addictive behaviors and the way we scroll social media or how we support loved ones with addiction. We're going to talk about it all, try to unpack this conversation a bit further and give you some tangible action steps and application, just some ways that you can leverage some of the science of wonder and curiosity, wonder in action, to do some of this kind of work in your life. So tune in next week for that episode with Kate, the Afterglow episode. All right, that's it for this episode of The Wild Level Life. I'm Harris III. Thank you so much for listening. Remember, keep that wonder alive. It will change what you believe, and what you believe will change what you see. All right, magic is real. Go experience some of it. We'll talk to you again very soon.